You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. Welcome to After Images' David Lynch tribute episode. Like so many of the artist's admirers, we were deeply saddened by the news of Lynch's recent passing. Please join us in honoring a versatile filmmaker, musician, visual artist, and meditator in the company of author Ramsey Campbell, comic book artist Knut Larsson, television writer and producer Harley Payton, filmmaker and writer Brian Usna, and author William Boyle. Welcome to After Images podcast. We're here with a group of guests for whom the work of David Lynch has been very important, either through inspiration via his films and artwork or through collaborations and meetings. And we are delighted to be joined by this wonderful group of guests to pay tribute to David Lynch. And so I think we'll begin simply by asking our guests, and our first guest today is Ramsey Campbell. What does David Lynch's work mean to you?
Well, put simply, he's the only filmmaker whose work has frequently terrified me on a sheer visceral level, almost to the point where in several cases I felt, you know, if this goes on very much longer like this, I shall have to go away and come back again, see it another day. So, I mean, for instance, the breakfast table scene in Fire Walk With Me, for even the scene when she acquires this painting, where I knew perfectly well that something dreadful, you know, that door was going to open. And in very much an M.R. Jamesian sense, something like the mezzo tint. And by gum, did I wish it was not going to open, although what happened was not quite as bad as I feared. Above all, I suppose, Lost Highway. I've seen Lost Highway a considerable number of times. I've written an essay on it, an appreciation. But the first half hour or so of that movie, I find almost relentlessly terrifying, in a way that I found very difficult to describe, but very, very easy to appreciate. I suppose what I do feel is this, you know, I've tried to put it together in my head, and the best thing I can come up with is this, that just as Hitchcock would use all the elements of cinema to communicate, well, often suspense, so David Lynch, it seems to be, uses all the elements of cinema, you know, camera movement, framing, performance, you know, obviously the dialogue, the script, also crucially sound design, to communicate a sense of the uncanny, like nobody else ever has in my experience. So that's just part of what he means to me. I mean, I've been in love with his work ever since I saw Eraserhead at a midnight showing at the London Film Festival back in the year when it was released. In fact, I was told by an old friend, the anthologist Michel Parry, that it was a film I absolutely had to go and see. But he made it pretty clear that, well, at the time, it seemed very unlikely it would show up anywhere other than that at the London Film Festival. So I went down to London. I mean, there's a couple of hundred miles trip to see it. It was a midnight show, as I say, London Film Festival. It was showing two consecutive midnights, and I was staying with my publisher, Tom Tessier. And I booked tickets. Well, I booked tickets for myself the first night, and Tom wanted to go the second night. And when I came away on the first night, I felt I'd lived through somebody else's nightmare for 90 minutes. And I genuinely felt, I don't know if I could do that again. But you know, I was so anxious to see it again, because it might have been the only other time I ever did. And I did go along and see it again the following night, and it had just as much inexplicable power. And I think for me, this word inexplicable, or perhaps more precisely indefinable, is going to come up again and again. So that's just a little bit of my experience of David Lynch.
He had a very strong ability to drag the audience into his dream world, into his nightmares, didn't he?
Yes.
Is this something, that's the thing that really scared you, to be taken into this dream world?
It's something like that, but it's more... I'm not entirely sure. You see, I rewatched, Jenny and I, my wife, watched Fire Walk With Me just a couple of days back, as a bit of a tribute. And I found it worked somewhat differently for me now. I find that what in, well, I say the real world scenes, well, I suppose they are relatively real world. Whereas with something like Eraserhead, you feel if in at some point in Eraserhead, if this is a dream, what in heaven's name is the film proposing as reality? Twin Peaks, there is, well, not exactly naturalism. There's at least some sense of something like the real world. Well, Twin Peaks itself and the relationships between the characters. And I found the whole business with her father and Bob, again, almost intolerably disturbing. But on the other hand, I found that this time I found the Red Room and the rest of the occult elements, while some of them obviously are a source of the menace, I think there's also a sort of sense of occult redemption that had not really come over to me quite this way before. And possibly because we, alas, lost David Lynch itself, but it seemed to shift onto a slightly different level for me this time around.
He had the ability to somehow put the finger on repressed elements that we don't really want to see, didn't he?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's what makes him the greatest. Well, the no longer living, sadly. This is going to keep coming up quite obviously. But while he was with us, it seemed to be the greatest living surrealist by far. Now, I don't know if you folks will have seen, he did do a documentary film about surrealism for the BBC, I think. I mean, was that shown more widely? You have seen it, I guess. Yeah. But I find it very strange that unless I missed it, and I don't think I did, the only filmmaker he never referred to was Buñuel. He doesn't that Buñuel does not seem to come up in that film. I don't know quite why. In a way, it doesn't matter. But it seemed to me that the filmmaker with whom he had the strongest affinity, insofar as he had any affinity, was except rather than being utterly unique. Was Buñuel in a number of different ways, really. I mean, the whole business of shifting of identity is often crucial to both, and it's not the same as magic realism, but this almost matter-of-fact acceptance of the uncanny and the strange, and simply allowing it to happen in the course of the narrative rather than drawing any particular attention to it, seems to me to be more Buñuelian than it is like any other filmmaker, apart obviously from Lynch himself.
Oh, it's interesting. We were just talking about this because there's always this debate about was Lynch a cinephile or not? And I think that Arena show really indicates the extent of his knowledge of
Oh,
early
yes.
experimental films. But they do spend quite a bit of time in that program looking at Cocteau, for
Yes,
example.
that's right.
Blood of a Poet. And then we have a lot of references to more of an American surrealist, Maya Deren, who Lynch has often spoken about. But you're right, I don't recall. It's been a while since I've seen the program. I don't recall if there's a reference to Buñuel.
I don't think there was a reference to Buñuel in that program. I mean, the program was mostly about dreams that money can buy.
Yes, that's right.
Film from 1945 that was a collage of the works of various European and American surrealist filmmakers of the time. And yes, I mean, then Cocteau plays also a role in this because he's also talking about Blood of a Poet.
And Orpheus, I think,
And
as well.
Orpheus, I think, is definitely referenced in season 3 of Twin Peaks, among other things. But perhaps Harley knows more about the influences that were important to David Lynch when it comes to surrealist cinema in particular, or filmmaking in
Well,
general.
it's funny because I was thinking just the opposite in a weird way, that for me, and that includes my experience on Twin Peaks, David was a mainstream filmmaker. He just redefined what mainstream was. But there was something about him that was aggressively normal while being surreal at the same time. And that's why to me he was just singular. I mean, it makes sense that he played John Ford, in the Spielberg movie. It's like that was perfect because David was, I mean, he was many things, obviously, but I just feel there was something strangely normal, certainly about him in person. And when you got to know him and when you worked with him, I mean, people, there's the cliches about the gee whiz David Lynch and all this stuff, but that was sort of true. And I think that the in a way that I've never seen anyone else do, certainly, I mean, maybe there are examples of this in other countries where there's a filmmaker who occupies a place in the mainstream, but at the same time is doing something so completely outside it, or is redefining the mainstream while they're working. But when you look at things like Blue Velvet, or I mean, Elephant Man, I think is an outlier because if memory serves, it was his least pleasant experience because he had to deal with people giving him notes, and so he there was there were certain ba you know he had to rebel against certain strictures there. Although it's one of my favorite movies he ever made, but yeah, it's interesting. I think for him, I think of him as being, and Twin Peaks was the best, one of the best distillations of that. I mean, it was a soap opera, right? And there are things about it that couldn't have been more normal, whether it's apple pie or letter jackets for the jocks to wear, right? I mean, those things are all kind of these American archetypes that he not only loved to explore, but just loved. So that's how I've always thought about him. And although there's obviously different examples, but if you saw Eraserhead and then said, well, this is what's going to happen to this guy's career, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, you just wouldn't. And yet he developed in such a way, and his world grew in such a way that, you know, he's left behind all this wonderful work. And I feel like it's more mainstream than people credit sometimes. And I don't mean mainstream as a criticism at all. I mean, I think of, you know, Godard in his way as redefining the mainstream, right? I mean, I think that's what certain people are able to do, and I think David was certainly one of them.
But in a sense, isn't that what surrealism is all about? It's about bringing the dream world and colliding it with reality. It's about integrating the two of them into a coherent whole. And isn't that, in a way, what he did with, I'm thinking about Twin Peaks here. Really have the two coexist without putting one on top of the other.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And he loved to play with time. So if a woman's going to scream in horror at the death of her daughter, it's going to be a really long scream. And I know that sounds simplistic, but that's something that he loved doing. I mean, in season three, that guy sweeps up in the fucking bar for like an hour, right? It's like that's just, I mean, he was always at play, and just watching him work as a director, I think that might be the most important thing. That he
Would
wasn't,
you?
you always hear about directors as being generals marshaling an army, but David wasn't doing that. He was at play. And so that allowed for certain inspirations to come. I remember they were shooting a scene, a morgue scene, an autopsy scene, and suddenly the light started flickering up above because there was a short in it. And on 99.9% of sets, the director would be very upset about that. The electrical would be shuffling around madly to try to get it fixed. But David just loved it and went, "That's neat. Let's just keep shooting." Right? In other words, he was always in the moment in such a way, and I think that's why actors loved working with him. And I think a lot of the things that he did, it wasn't, I mean, obviously there are things that are planned and all of that. And I think when he and Mark worked together, that was part of their synergy. But his ability to be in the moment and direct that way is, I think it's rare.
I was going to say, how quintessential Holly do you think the straight story is?
The which story?
The straight story.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another one. It's like, it's. My memory of that is not as good as the others, to be perfectly honest. But I do think it, but I think that, but just the title, I mean, that's how David was working. He was always subverting your expectations, but at the same time, he did sort of cleave to them. In other words, I mean, you look at Blue Velvet and that wonderful world and slow motion, you know, fire trucks rolling past. There's just something about it that, and it's become a bit of a cliche when talking about David that, you know, he was so American and yet was anti to it at the same time, apple pie and so on. But I think it's sort of true. I mean, he was a quite a character both as an individual and as a director.
I think we'll move on to Knut. Would you like to tell us what Lynch meant to you? And I know that you've met Lynch several times, so tell us about that.
Well, since I saw Twin Peaks in the early 90s, he pretty soon became my hero artist. He was a big inspiration for me, and really someone I really looked up to. And as you have said before, there was something very frightening about the first time when you get to know his work. And but as soon as that frightening sort of it's sort of almost like a layer in front of everything else. When you pass that layer, there's a lot of beauty and humor and a lot of sweetness also. But there's also in almost all his work, except I guess The Straight Story, it's a sort of a wall of horror or some sort of unheimlich ambience. But anyhow, he became important to me, and when he came to Stockholm, where I live, in 2003, he came to collect the Stockholm Film Festival prize. And I contacted his site because at that time he had the davidlynch.com site, and I had an email address, so I emailed them and said that I have to meet David. He's very important to me. And I was very surprised because it hadn't taken an hour before I got an answer. They said, "Sure, you can meet David after the ceremony, and but you should go to this hotel and this hotel number, but don't tell anyone." So it was very hush hush, and but anyhow, I was super nervous, and I went to that hotel. And in the lobby, there he was with his bodyguard, or it was some kind of guy who watched over him, I guess. And I took a leap of faith and stepped forward. And he looked very suspicious on me at first. But then I said, I'm a member of your site. We're supposed to meet." And he said, "Oh, you're a dot-commer." And he stretched out his hand, and that then he turned into this super nice guy, and so that was probably the first and longest of our meetings. The other meetings were more short and friendly, but that night we had time of just a few people to sit down and talk at his hotel room in Stockholm. And he was, as many can witness, he was somehow very down to earth, and a very kind person, and very reluctant to talk about his movies. I remember telling him that I saw Lost Highway 11 times at the movies, and he said, "Oh, good." And I tried to pick his brain for some details, but no such luck.
No, David doesn't explain.
No, he really didn't like that. And over time, I really come to understand why he doesn't do that. I think there's like two parts. One part is I think he doesn't really have the correct words to describe the abstract things in his movies, maybe. And the other aspect is it's supposed to be the audience who does the work. It's like abstract paintings or something. You can't have the artist standing next to the abstract painting saying what it is. It's up to the audience. They're supposed to do the work, the detective work.
But this is an element that I find very interesting and paradoxical, in that he always said that the audience was there to analyze the film on their own, that somehow the artist was supposed to disappear behind the work. But at the same time, he is one of the most recognizable persona in the world of cinema. When you talk about film directors today, that the audience might know, they might know Alfred Hitchcock, they might know Steven Spielberg. And I think that a lot of people know David Lynch because he was a real character himself. So I think it's interesting this contradiction between disappearing behind the work and never talking about the work, but also at the same time, becoming iconic. I don't know
But
it's
part of that, I think, I mean, yeah, you could be in line at the grocery store with P.T. Anderson and you wouldn't know. right? It just you it's not something that would come up. But the thing about David, and it's there's a lot of great artists. They're usually it's usually painters, but or sculptors, but a lot of artists who have the aspect, and this will sound critical, but it's not at all, of they're art hustlers. And they, in other words, there's something innate in them where they know how to create not only their art, but to create a world for their art to exist in. And part of that creation is self-creation, right? And I don't think David probably spent 10 seconds thinking about how he looked. But I mean, I do think that just maybe naturally he also created, I mean, one of his greatest creations was David Lynch, right? I mean, he became this iconic figure in the way he behaved, the way he discussed or wouldn't discuss, the way he looked. I mean, that it's all part and parcel of that larger David Lynch project. And that is really rare, right? And again, that's why the John Ford thing was so great for me, because Ford was another one who really created both a mythos around himself and just the way he looked and behaved, as well as what he was making and putting onto the screen. But I think that's why, again, David to me is so singular, because he was able to do that.
And he could have been a character in one of his movies. I mean, they were really in
He
sync.
was in the TV show. Yeah, absolutely.
But this is why I think it's also interesting. I was talking about Hitchcock, who also had a very strong persona, but with Hitchcock, it was the opposite. It was very thought out. I mean, he really put himself into that kind of character. It was not something natural. I really think that he was directing his own role as a human being, as a film director. Whereas for David Lynch, it felt very natural and very down to earth. And at the end of the line, they both remain in the public memory as unforgettable
Absolutely.
beings.
And one very interesting thing also is at the sort of end of his life, he became almost like a spiritual leader, because he became really involved in this transcendental meditation organization, and he became a sort of an ambassador for it. And I myself have been a meditator for 15 years now, inspired by David, of course. But I see among my friends and among people in general that even though they may not be meditators, they are sort of deeply moved by his sort of how do you, his spiritual persona in media. And so you know, when he passed away, all my friends and all acquaintances on Facebook, people are pretty devastated, because he meant something more than just being a great director and artist, because people really saw something genuinely good in him. He was some sort of you know, like a white magician, sort of a Gandalf of of Hollywood or something. And that's pretty rare.
Totally. I was very struck by how much grief there is in the Lynch community, of people who, like me, have never met him personally. And it really came as a shock, even though we knew that he was sick. It really was a shock. And I'm younger than him, so he had always been part of my world. I mean, I never lived before that in a world before David, where in which David Lynch was not there too. And all of a sudden, he's not there, and will never be there ever again. And there's a big hole. And I think that a lot of people felt that when we found out that he had died. I don't know if that's also something that you felt. I mean, Holly, obviously you knew him personally, so that's different. But I mean, for the people who never met him, I mean, did you also feel this? William, for instance?
Yeah, I did. I did feel that. I mean, and he's been there my whole life too. As I said, I got into him and his films first, obviously, when I was a kid. And I mean, I think also the timing of it, with the fires and all that's going on here. I think, everybody knew he was sick, but I think we hoped that he could kind of we know that he's always working. We've known that. He's always one of the things that's so amazing about him as an artist is that I think even when he's when he's not making films or when he couldn't get funding for films, he was always working on other things. And I think you had the sense that he was out there working, and there was something beautiful about that. And I think I mean, I know I held out hope that he'd direct something remotely, or he would maybe even direct like a little kind of claustrophobic two-hander in his house or something. I mean, I think we all expected and hoped there was, that he was going to go kind of the Eastwood route somehow and keep directing into his late 80s and early 90s, or keep, just keep making art. And so it hit very hard. Yeah, I mean, I heard that from many people, like that don't I don't think there are people out there who don't understand grieving kind of celebrities or artists. And I get that to a certain extent, but I mean, I think I always grieve when someone whose work I admire, is gone. But this one, he was my greatest artistic hero, I think. And this one hit in a way that, very, very few, things, and not even celebrity deaths or deaths of artists, like death person in my life, like people I've known, this felt like, like my grandparents passing away or something. It felt closer to that because even though I never met him, never knew him, I mean, there's a connection there and a communion there through the art. And that's been, for me, it's been, 35 years of my life of, of that being stuff I love the most and go back to the most. So yeah, it's definitely been a grieving process.
Well, and condolences to all of you, because I know that Lynch meant so much to all of you. And Harley, I hope you're hanging in there all right, because I know that Lynch was a colleague of yours, and also a friend. Could we ask what Lynch meant to you? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the context of how you met and your early
Well, I mean,
experience.
it's funny because I came into the process as an acquaintance of Mark Frost. And then Mark and I actually became great friends during the making of the show. We used to have lunch every day. That was our standing date to have lunch during production. And didn't really talk about the show that much during those lunches. But I remember before the second season, I'd written two episodes in the first season, and so they were putting together the team for the second season, and they needed a producer, not just a writer. And so I had to kind of audition for David. And so we had breakfast at DuPar's in the Valley, which is a classic kind of 50s diner. And we were, and this is and that was really the because David was making Wild at Heart during the first season, he wasn't there as much. So I had, the opportunity to see him, but I didn't really have any time to spend with him. And so we had this wonderful breakfast. And the first thing we discovered was simply that we are from the same world. I mean, he was born in Missoula. His sister was born in Spokane, where I'm from. He then lived in Sandpoint, Idaho, where I'd spent a lot of time. And so I think there was just a sense of a kind of affinity based on geography in a weird way. And that, by the way, Mark Frost being from Minnesota sort of qualified for the same thing. Every one of us was familiar with things in the woods. So I think that that was really the start of that. And then, you go through this process, and it's again, it's he was a hero of mine at the time too. So that's where you start because of Blue Velvet and his work. But over time, it just became a working relationship. And it was always the synergy between Mark and David was so special, I think also very fragile. But that was, and I was really kind of sitting to the side of that and trying to contribute as much as I could. But I remember in that second season, we had a suite of offices sort of with a common area, and down below were all the sets. So you could walk down some stairs and suddenly you were in Twin Peaks land. You were in the Haywards living room. It was like this a kind of amazing way to make television. And David's office was directly across from mine. And the only thing that was in his office were two chairs. That was it. So he, you could, you know, he was going to sit in one and someone else might be sitting there with him. But I mean, I think, yeah, you learn a great deal from someone. I had a chance to watch him direct all the time because I was there, and I just had to walk down the stairs because there are certain scenes I wanted to see David do. And that was a great pleasure for me. Our relationship became more fractious when I told him there are certain things he couldn't do when Mark was away directing a movie and I was left in charge at a young age. But we got through that as well. So it was a wonderful experience for me. And listen, David and Mark, but David changed the course of my life as a writer, certainly. So that's something that's probably the primary thing for me when I think about him and what we went through.
You don't get asked what were the things he couldn't do.
Oh, it's the thing about David is that David, and this is why, by the way this thing worked in the first season, David didn't think of himself as someone who was going to do television, right? And there was this insane agent named Tony Krantz, who was my agent, and he was a television agent, and he was Mark's agent when Mark was at CAA. And Tony was very good at putting people together. He put Michael Crichton together with the people who did ER. He kept having these insane ideas about, well, maybe I get David to do a television show. And so he put Mark and David together. And so that was, but David was really never thought of himself as making television, and he never thought in a serial way. David wasn't thinking about the inspiration I have today directing episode three has ramifications in episode nine, right? I mean, that just wasn't how he thought. So when Mark went away, I was left, you know, sort of in charge. Although Mark and I were on the phone every day, and it was all very, you know, organized. But there was a director, Steve Holland, who a very good director, and he had this whole complicated opening shot. He was all ready to go, and he called me at like 11 at night and said, "I just got off the phone with David. He gave me all these script notes, and it'll wreck my day tomorrow." And also with this show, people are always going places. Piper Laurie's on a plane the next day. If I can't shoot her tomorrow, I lose her for the. I mean, he was having a meltdown, and I said, "Look, shoot your day as planned. Right? Don't change a thing. I'll talk to David. We love him having notes about or thoughts about anything, but you can't give thoughts to a director at 11 o'clock at night when they're shooting the next morning at 7." So I then called Mark, of course. I'm not going to call David and say, "Would you?" And I explained the whole situation to him. And Mark said, "Fine, I'll talk to David." But Mark, who was directing movie in New Orleans, was unable to make that phone call. So it was one of those kind of communication breakdowns. And so my phone rang the next day, and David was not happy because, you know, I was unable to do what he wanted, and that's fine, I get it. But it was quite something for me, the sort of young writer going, I was sort of honored that David Lynch was yelling at me for 5 minutes. But you know, but that was his passion too. And he was passionate about the project and passionate about the work. And he wasn't, you know, I'm sure that his thoughts were extraordinary, right? I mean, it's David Lynch, for God's sakes. But it was a complicated thing then, although that passed rather quickly. But you know, he didn't want, and listen, every great artist spends their lives with people telling him how great they are. Right. I mean, at some point for a great artist, that's pretty much it. Right. And I think David was probably impacted by that less than most, but there certainly isn't a great artist who isn't impacted by it. All right. You can't help it. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like. But I mean, if you are told that, you know, every idea you have is the best possible idea, you know, it becomes difficult to kind of, you know, to kind of make those determinations. But again, I'm not, David thought in a way that was completely unique. So it's not like it's very hard to go, well, you know, to be fair, you're really not connecting A and B and C. That seems like a ridiculous exercise and would have been. But yeah, that was my one experience in kind of trying to produce David, which did not go well.
But what you said about connecting to him because of the place where you both lived is very interesting. And I want to actually ask Brian, who lives in Los Angeles, if the fact that some of the movies that David Lynch shot are in Los Angeles might be one of the reasons that made him feel close to the artist, or if it's a different sort of relationship that he has to the films of David Lynch.
I do think he, I mean, he obviously represented Southern California on a lot of his movies. But with stuff like that, I thought it was interesting with Blue Velvet that he shot it in North Carolina. And he kind of made it, it was kind of set in North Carolina, in kind of every town USA, but it seemed kind of more like the Pacific Northwest. And I lived in North Carolina when I first saw Eraserhead. I went up to New York to see it at the midnight show at the same time Ramsey, I think that same year, whenever it came out, it was kind of a, a sort of one of the, you had to go see this, but I thought it was interesting how he kind of made North Carolina the more like the Northwest. I didn't know he had grown up in the Northwest until right now. And now it makes a little more sense. And I guess he made that, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Dino De Laurentiis back that movie? And Dino De Laurentiis had a studio on the coast of North Carolina. And I know that Lynch had a lot of made a lot of jokes about Dino and the Italians. And one of my favorite is in the in Mulholland Drive, where the Italian gangster director, or I don't know, somehow whoever these great gods of cinema are, and he doesn't like the espresso, and you kind of can, I don't know, I think that there's a lot of very personal stuff in there. I think that's one of the things that appealed to me. For me, I think the movie that really got me into Lynch, I mean, besides just being one of those crazy kind of experimental filmmakers, was Blue Velvet, because it I think if at the time it I remember it being like using sound in a way that nobody did at that time. And today we're so used to sound design and sound being such a huge part of all movies. At that time, it was really different how he used it, and it was real dreamlike to me. And he also did it with the camera work. He had this in Blue Velvet anyway. I was so impressed by, he'd have these underlit scenes, kind of find some texture and kind of subtle colors in it with that sound design. I forget who did them. I think it was credited as music. I forget who did the music for Blue Velvet. I thought, I mean, for me, Blue Velvet is the one that kind of gave me a sense of what he was doing. The idea that you could do experimental, kind of abstract filmmaking in a commercial product and kind of have it all hold together in a way. It's a little bit like Bob Dylan's lyrics back in the 60s, when you just knew Bob Dylan was, it was just free associative. Which is a lot of, I think a lot of creativity is exact is free associative. If you go too far with it, you get real arty and inexplicable. If you're able to make it a product, I think you're able to maybe channel that free association a bit.
He was always
Pardon?
the edge, always.
Well, I think one of the greatest examples of Bob Dylan doing that was in that documentary about him. I'm trying to remember the name of it, that was in the 60s. And I remember he had these cards with words on them. And he would throw the cards and do his blues rap while he was doing it. And you think of some of his, well, I think his, that 60s stuff is the greatest Dylan stuff. And I'm not necessarily talking about the folk, civil rights stuff, but the just this free associative stuff, and somehow it would all make sense. Mm-hmm. And somehow these totally disparate, crazy, intense words would all kind of come together and make a song that you could repeat, and somehow it meant something to you. And I feel a little bit like that was what attracted me to David Lynch. I think his, and you know, when I saw Blue Velvet, I just thought he had kind of, on the one hand, made it so familiar, so small town, so kind of rural small town, and then had such fun, so much humor thrown right in there. So it's not really all that serious. I mean, from the point that the Kyle MacLachlan goes into the hardware store and what is it? One of the guys is blind or something, and he gets, it's just funny. It's not, it really has nothing to do with, you know, where the movie's going, except in its own. But then it gets stranger and stranger to the point where you really feel like this is really, you know, you're going into a dark place, a real dark place. Now, I always felt like the end of Blue Velvet, to me, the third act was a disappointment because I felt like in the third act, he kind of had to wrap it up in a way that made a story. Don't think it didn't live up to where we had gone before that. And I sort of feel like the moment when that happened was when Kyle MacLachlan is taken from the weird, I don't know what it is, some sort of weird, ugly brothel or, you know, and when they finally take him out to do bad to him. And what they do is they beat him up. And at the moment that was the payoff that was going to come from these incredibly bad people, depraved people, I felt like the regular story didn't quite add up to the you know, to that experimental or that, I don't know, more cinematic kind of free associative stuff. At the end, I thought he pulled it together beautifully because it's a, you know, when he has the image of the bird eating the worm underneath the beautiful Edenish small town suburbia, and I mean, this is a theme that every sophomoric film student, I'm sure, has realized that beneath all the beauty of the world is this ugly, ugly snake eating tail. You know, this. But I think Lynch pulled it off just masterfully. You know, so that was sort of what got me into Lynch, and ultimately, I love Mulholland Drive the best.
I'm just prompted by what you were saying about the beating up there, Brian. I think we all probably recall that there's one scene in Blue Velvet where apparently, you know, folk around Lynch said, "Listen, Dave, we think you've gone too far this time." It's the killing of Harry Dean Stanton, which I gather was originally a lot more disturbing in some way, because I think isn't the basic idea that the perpetrators have an orgasm after they've, or while they're killing him?
I felt like there should have been a sexual violence aspect. But even that is a little, to me, it's almost like a bit today, especially sort of cliched, because we have a certain context narrative context that we put all this stuff in. I feel like what you were saying, that you felt fear going into watching some Lynch. I'm not sure if I didn't feel fear, but I felt kind of a disturbing, nightmarish, kind of an obsession with, an attraction to, like, where is this going to go? And when Kyle MacLachlan decides to hide in the apartment and spy Rosalini, I completely bought that on a narrative level. To me, I mean, that I feel like he really had the narrative. I totally believe this kind of stuff. And then when he witnesses her relationship, and the with some kind of gas and the baby, I mean, that stuff had a, I don't know what the, I don't know what the logic is behind it. I'm sure you could come up with a lot, but it had a sense of reality to me. Had a sense whether it's invented reality or if it's based on something, or I feel like that to me is what just attracts me big time. When it doesn't, when then you do have to bring it back to being a picturesque narrative. And I presume that's what was being referenced by doing the TV shows, doing the, you know, realizing that it has to actually still be a story, and you do have to know from episode three what's how that's going to work with episode nine, and it becomes such a it's such a kind of a engineering feat of narrative. And I think that's why I went with the great series and limited series today. What's so admirable is to be able to put that kind of free, you know, almost experimental feelings and usages of cinema within a structure that anybody can watch and follow. And sometimes I think David Lynch was able to do that.
But his depiction of small town America feels, I suppose, very real to the Americans in this virtual room. But what about people in Liverpool and in Stockholm? How do you relate to this aspect of his work, to his Americana?
Well, it rings true to me, but then, obviously that's so, of course, I have occasionally visited America anyway, so I've been in places not entirely like that, but small towns for sure. And yeah, it rings true. But I suppose, so I mean, in almost every other way, they're very different. But I suppose Steve King does some of the things with small towns. I guess I became, attuned to that sort of setting through both of them, and to something a little bit through, actual visiting lived experience.
And what about you, Knut?
Yeah, well, I think it feels true, not on the realistic level, but it feels true and on a deeper, more dreamlike level, where the very experience of it is the focus, not the exact facts of things. I want to mention another thing that David did so many things apart from movies, and for example, he did a comic strip for LA, I think it LA Times, from the early 80s to the early 90s, and it's called The Angriest Dog in the World. And I have been I've been reading some of his strips lately, and I just have to read one strip for you guys, because it felt so it feels that we need that right now in the world. And I have to say also, it's a comic strip, and it's also the same images every time it was published, but just the word balloons were switched. Anyhow, this strip is really great. And it says first, "The dog who is so angry he cannot move, he cannot eat, he cannot sleep, he can just barely growl. Bound so tightly with tension and anger, he approaches the state of rigor mortis." And then someone says in the house where he's tied to, "I think the entire world is Swiss made." "Why the hell do you say that?" "Because everybody's cuckoo." The end. And that's sort of a very Lynch humor, I think.
Yeah, it's very absurdist. There's a lot of absurdism, I think, in his work, and
But very sweet as well.
yes, yeah.
I just realized, though, that William, we didn't actually get to the original question. You didn't get to tell us. We know that you're
Oh.
fans of a fan of Lynch since you were 12, you mentioned earlier, and I just wanted to give you a chance to maybe talk about your first experiences with Lynch.
Yeah, sure. And so I was I think 11 when Twin Peaks aired. So I didn't see Twin Peaks when it was on for whatever reason, but then by chance 12 was a big year for me when I got into a lot of stuff that kind of changed my life. And I think so I missed that original run of Twin Peaks, but I rented Blue Velvet one Saturday afternoon. I was, you know, a compulsive movie watcher already at that point, but I was really, by about 12, I was really starting to kind of explore more and go beyond just kind of, you know, the stuff I grew up watching. And I was watching a lot of movies, as many as I could every week. So I rented Blue Velvet one afternoon, and it was really like, you know, I mark it in my life as kind of a before that moment and after that moment. It was kind of, you know, changed my way of seeing, totally altered my way of seeing the world. I remember I watched it in the afternoon on a Saturday, as I said, and I went to church, to mass with my mother and my grandparents at 5 o'clock that night. And it was just, you know, like this, you know, I mean, it sounds cliche to say it, but literally my life had been changed. My vision of things had been changed. And I think, you know, getting back to kind of what we were just talking about, that's one thing he did. And when you're talking about kind of like his vision of America stuff, I don't think it matters if it was realistic or anything like that. It was just kind of, it changed the way we saw things. Like, so things became Lynchian in life, like, you know, blinking streetlights, electrical sockets, headlights on the road, whatever. Everything, you know, everything was seen through a different lens. So Blue Velvet was my first experience. And then I actually, you know, I saw, I guess, Wild at Heart next, because that came out around then when I was, you know, probably, I don't know, 12 going on 13 or just 13. So I saw that, love that, kind of made me fall in love with Barry Gifford's work too, who's been a big influence on me as well. I saw Fire Walk with Me before I ever saw the show, which is an interesting thing to think about in retrospect. And I loved Fire Walk with Me then. I love it even more now. And then I went into a phase as I got into later in high school, early college, where, you know, the kind of great phase where I got to see things in the theater as they came out. So I saw Lost Highway the day it came out, and, you know, I saw The Straight Story in the theater. In college, my first year of college, I went to a college in this kind of little hippie town called New Paltz in the Hudson Valley in New York, and there was a cool video store. So it was my freshman year of college was when I got to watch Twin Peaks, the series, because they had it on VHS at this video store. So, you know, watched all of that in a couple of weeks or a few weeks as quickly as I could, and, you know, became my favorite thing ever. And saw Mulholland Drive when it came out, in the theater, saw Inland Empire when it came out in the theater, and, you know, and then and, you know, then there was that long kind of drought in terms of the film and TV work. And somewhere in there, I published my first novel in 2013. And then this filmmaker, actor named George Griffith got in touch with me and wanted to adapt one of my books, my first book. And it didn't work out, but George and I got to be really good friends and worked on a couple other things together. And then George, you know, who's also a, you know, tremendous David Lynch fan, got cast in Twin Peaks: The Return. And I didn't know it. He wasn't allowed to talk about it. So we were talking a lot during that time. But then when the cast list got announced, we could finally talk about it. And yeah, the return, I think, is, you know, the greatest thing this century, whether you want to call it a film or a show or whatever. I often think about it as kind of the greatest piece of American art ever made. And it was, cool to be watching that week to week and to be kind of, calling George and listening to him tell me stories. And he's in episode eight, of course. So one of my fondest memories of watching The Return was just talking to him the day after that aired and, feeling like I'd just seen the best thing I'd ever seen. And, talking to one of the only other actors who's in that episode. So yeah, it's been a long, long love affair with Lynch's work. I love, the way he kind of pulls in influences from various genres. I love film noir, and obviously I was drawn to him in part because of that, because he kind of treads in that territory a lot. But I do, and we were talking, you guys were talking about the horror elements of his work earlier, and I think when I think of the scariest moments, the moments that have truly scared me in films, I always think of Lynch movies first. I mean, there is almost no horror movie that I can think of that has scarier moments than Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway and The Return and Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart for that matter. And so, I love the way he has this ability to move between genres. That the humor in his work, we were talking about that before. The kind of slapstick elements of his work. I rewatched Mulholland Drive the other day, and I just, the scene, which I guess would have been, a larger threat if it had gotten picked up as a show, when the woman gets shot through the wall, and something bit me bad. Just great, great, just hilarious moments. I mean, I think the guy sweeping the floor in The Return is it just like when I was watching that, I was just laughing so much. I mean, I don't know, that ability to just you never knew what the next moment was going to be, and that there's such incredible tension that comes with that. We think about and rely on formula so much, and people take comfort in the familiar. And storytelling so much that, one of the things that I loved about Lynch was just that the unpredictability, the ability to follow what he was interested in and what he was interested in seeing. It also, ramble on too much longer, but the my early experiences with Lynch were definitely the first times in my life where I really wanted to. I couldn't get things out of my mind. Like, I couldn't get his movies and shows out of my mind, and I wanted to study them and think, I was thinking about them nonstop. I just wanted to read whatever I could read. I wanted to talk to people about them. So it was really, I think, and it's still like this, with his work. Like, I always feel that desire to kind of communicate with others about it, or to hear what others are thinking and saying. And that's been a really beautiful part of loving his work.
So, Ramsey, thank you so much for being with us. Is there anything you'd like to say before you have to leave us or?
Well, I suppose only to assuage the grief a little bit, we've got the entire body of his work, and that will never die, nor I suspect will all the enigmas that he gives us. So, thank you, Mr. Lynch. I wish I'd met you.
William, I wanted also to talk about. I mean, you are a specialist of music, and Brian was mentioning the importance of sound in the works of David Lynch. Is there something you'd like to say, perhaps, about his use of sound and music and the sort of environment he was creating with that?
Yeah, well, I think, like I was just saying, I mean, I think he was, and somebody said this earlier too, he was probably the first filmmaker for me who made me think about that stuff, and really, you saw, I don't know what I thought about movies before I encountered Lynch's work, but it did feel like oh, you know, I had this realization that, oh, this is what movies do. You know, this is why movies are unique. It's the words, it's the images, it's the sounds, it's the music, it's all this stuff coming together. And he was the first filmmaker to really make me think about that stuff. So I was certainly more aware of sound design in his movies than I had ever been in anything. And I think that's still true. I mean, I don't think I watch anything for the sound the way I watch his movies for the sound. And then of course music. I mean, you know, the Angelo Badalamenti scores, the way he used, you know, the kind of the needle drops, the way he used music in the films and shows. There's just nothing like it. I mean, it was all massive, you know, for me. The you know, Rebecca Del Rio and Mulholland Drive and the bands, you know, the bands and the return and obviously Blue Velvet. I mean, it's music is foundational in all of his stuff. And particularly I think because I grew up, you know, in the 80s and 90s and, you know, I had my own taste in music was developing and certainly by the time I guess I was also probably around 12 was when like, you know, Nirvana came along and kind of changed things for me. But you know, I lived with my stepdad and my mom and my grandparents were close by. And so I certainly grew up listening to a lot of oldies and was, you know, kind of in love with a lot of that stuff. So seeing how he used that kind of 50s and 60s music was, you know, he made it cool to like that stuff. And that was important at the time. So yeah, I mean, it was just kind of there was I can't think of any other filmmaker, not only who used sound the way he used sound, but really who used music the way he used music. And yeah, it was massively inspiring and just yeah, another incredible aspect of his work.
One of the things that we touched on earlier was the fact that Lynch was always working on different projects. So if he wasn't making a film or a series, he might be making furniture or he might be participating in a documentary. We have the wonderful ArtLife film. And I think that another reason that people are grieving is because he shared so much of this process and he became such a personality, you know, through his YouTube broadcasts, giving the weather reports and all the kind of plethora of images and interviews that we have. I mean, my social media has just been filled, saturated the past few days with so many clips from different periods. And I feel we're very fortunate to have that. But it also contributes to this feeling of intimacy that we have, that we really know him and that he's come into our lives. So on that note, I was wondering if maybe you all had a favorite Lynch memory that you might like to share, whether it comes from a meeting in person or whether it's an anecdote that you heard him say in an interview or online, anything that you'd like to share to honor his memory today.
I could say something. When I met him in Stockholm, the first thing I noticed was he had big hands. You know, big hands. And that was sort of a interesting thing because I knew that he could really build stuff. He can build, you know, his own sets, and he can build furniture, and he can, you know, he's a painter and so on. So for me, that was a sort of a revelation that he had this, you know, he had this, I don't know how to say it, but I had this really, it reminded me of my grandfather's hands because he was a painter and a builder. So, you know, not just a guy who could read Kafka, he could also build stuff, so.
And I think that the environment, textures, the physical aspects of architecture are so important in his work. And it's interesting that you're saying this about his hands. I mean, his films to me feel very tactile. I mean, there's a lot of haptic feelings in his movies. And I do think that, I mean, you mentioned the fact that he was a painter. I think that that remains present throughout all his filmography. I mean, I don't know if he was a painter first and foremost, but that's definitely something that was there all the time.
Yeah.
And that's why I love Eraserhead so much, because it feels handmade, all of it. It feels very, it's like a very much like a moving painting.
I mean, for me, I think the thing that I remember is that David's relationship with actors, and part of that's based on the fact that the audition process is so artificial. And an actor comes in, they've got pages, they're going to read a scene for five stern-faced individuals sitting at a long table. But David didn't work that way. David just sat down with the actor and talked to them. And it made them feel, I think it was, I can't remember which, maybe Naomi Watts, but someone said it made her feel like a human. Like they were sitting there talking to David and he just wanted to know about them. And David would sort of vibe out whether or not they were right for the role. And he didn't have to see them read. He wasn't concerned about their ability to read lines off of a piece of paper. He wanted to know more about them as people. Which dovetails back to that Dupar's breakfast that we had. And there was this woman at the counter, completely coincidentally, we were in a booth, a woman at the counter who looked like she'd stepped out of a 50s Rock Hudson movie, for God's sakes. I mean, she was sort of beautiful, but sort of out of time. And David kept looking over, and then we were talking, and David literally walked over to her and just asked her if she'd ever acted, if she was interested in being in a television show. And as memory serves, that was Robin Lively, who played the young woman who kind of ensorcelled the two brothers, the mayor and his brother, and everyone who met her was immediately entranced. She's actually playing a waitress now in Landman, which I was kind of delighted to see. So she's in that universe. But yeah, so that's just David. I mean, it's on the one hand, it was that empathetic connection he had with actors. He would do anything for them, and as a result they would do anything for him. And so I think that there's all sorts of ways you could have an experience with David in production that might not be pleasant, but I don't think there's an actor who's ever worked with him who's complained about the experience. Because there's that, just it's the world that he created and the way he welcomed the actors into that world. And I know that everybody felt that way, certainly on Twin Peaks, but I would imagine also in the movies as well. Was just his ability to kind of communicate and welcome them into his process, into his world.
Before we move to William, I just wanted to say that I just thought about one thing that Knut said about the importance of the hand. And to me, when I was watching interviews of David Lynch, it was impressive to see his hand that was always moving like this when he was talking, as if he was...
Yeah.
As if the words were coming out of his hand. He was thinking with his hand. And that's the little something I wanted to say in relationship
that's
to
nice.
What you mentioned.
Yeah.
What about you, William? Is there a moment from his filmography or from his life that remains in memory?
I mean, you know, so many moments, I think, in the films and in the shows kind of had that impact on me. But I mean, seeing Mulholland Drive for the first time, my now wife, then girlfriend, and I had just moved to Austin, Texas in late 2001 from New York, and I don't remember when exactly we saw it, but we saw it sometime soon after getting there, and it was a midnight showing of it. Must have been, I think it came out in October 2001. It must have been right around then, because that was right around when we got there. And it was at this theater called the Dobie in Austin, which we lived right up the street from. And there was kind of a little weird, like, private room at the back of the theater that you could sit in on a love seat and kind of watch through a hole in the wall, watch the screen. And they're kind of, if I remember correctly, they're kind of saloon doors into this room. And we watched the movie from there. And at some point, not long into the movie, and the theater was otherwise mostly empty, if my memory is right, maybe totally empty. At some point, somebody wearing cowboy boots came and stood outside of the door into the room and stayed there for the whole movie. And it just felt like the perfect way to see Mulholland Drive. And so I always think about that moment. I always think about also, I went to LA in 2020, right before COVID, to visit George, who I mentioned. We were working on something. It's the only time I've been in LA in my life. And yeah, I love film noir. I love so many LA writers. So I've been reading, I probably read more about LA in my life than I've even read about New York. Probably read more LA writers than I've read New York writers. But that was my first time visiting. And this was, whatever, 2 years after The Return had come out. And George just really made it like a, and I'd heard from other people, other writer friends of mine who had spent time in LA and hated it, who had just kind of been talking down about LA to me for years. And I went there with George, and he just made it this very Lynch-centric experience. We had a party, or he had a party where a few people from The Return came over and hung out, and we drove by Lynch's house. And I remember driving, we were driving on Mulholland Drive, just listening to, the scores, the Badalamenti scores. I can't remember if we were listening to Twin Peaks or Blue Velvet or Mulholland Drive or one of them, maybe all of them, maybe a mix of all of them. And it was just a really beautiful way to experience LA. And I even I'd been I came home just being like, I want to move to LA this week. And COVID happened, and that kind of daydream got squashed. But it was a really special experience. And I also think if there's a moment when I was there that George was talking to Lynch's assistant at some point on the phone, and Lynch's assistant had told him that they had just the night before they'd screened Kingpin, the Farrelly Brothers movie, for Lynch, and he loved it. And it just brought me such joy that he was like, 25 years after that movie was released, or whatever it was, he got it shown to him and got a kick out of it. So yeah.
It's so great.
That's great. And Brian, I know you've met Lynch on several occasions, is that right? Do you have a
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. I think I missed
That I
it.
know of. No.
Yeah, who knows?
He did live in my neighborhood in the 80s before he moved up top. He did end up living up near Mulholland Drive, I guess. But I know he did live a couple blocks from me, and I remember once I walked my dogs by, and the gardener was blowing, they have these leaf blowers, and he was sweeping out the thing, and I looked to the ground and I saw a film strip. This is back when they had paper strips with brads in them, these old, Kinko printed strips. And I picked it up and took it, even under the sort of the disparaging eye of the gardener. And it was a strip called, I think it, boy, I should look it up, find it somewhere. I think it was called Ronnie Rocket.
Yeah.
And it was about, and all I remember was there was a kid, it was something to the subways in New York, and there was this character would throw his nose boogers across the room. I don't know, it seemed really disgusting to me. But in any case, I guess that's as close as I ever got to meeting David Lynch. I do remember the first when Eraserhead came out. I think he was on like one of the late night shows, because I remember seeing one of these like Tonight Show things. And maybe his David Letter was even around then,
Yeah,
something. And
Letterman loved him.
but they and there's the scene, there's the baby scene in Eraserhead, and whoever, if it was Letterman, was trying to get him to say, how did you do that? Because it looks very disturbing. And Lynch wouldn't say. Right? I said, no, I'm not going to say. And you, so you could just imagine any weird thing. But that also tied in for me much later when we started having extras on, I guess it was when DVDs came in, we started having extras,
you know,
and you started having commentaries, and Lynch wouldn't do the, I remember reading it, Lynch wouldn't do a commentary. He wouldn't talk about it. And said, why should I do that? You know? And I thought it was very similar to the baby thing. It's like most people I know, including myself, we love to talk about the process that we go through to do anything, even to make our cereal in the morning. You know, every, you know, we're so interested in kind of deconstructing our process. And Lynch wouldn't do it. And I remember at the time there was a little bit of, you know, at least people I knew kind of disparaged that a little bit. You know, like he's not giving enough or something. And I just always thought, you know, he's keeping the magic. He's instead of, you know, kind of doing all this process stuff, he's leaving it, he's leaving the mystery to it. And especially for his movies, I think that is real important because he is, his movies are mysterious. You know, and you don't want them to be able to be explained. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the guy who says, well, if I could explain it in words, I wouldn't have made the movie or I wouldn't have painted the painting. And there's a certain, I think, a certain truth to that on a level. I love seeing the process of movies, which I think very early in cinematic criticism, the, you know, a movie should show the actual process of the movie making, that was considered the higher art form. I don't believe that, but I do appreciate it a lot. And for me, the appreciation of something like Mulholland Drive is really heightened by having read about the process of which that movie got developed. And then being able to look at it and go, oh, this was the part that was going to be part of the series that had to be truncated. And this is how he folded it in on itself. And the kind of that surrealistic, inexplicable nature of the narrative in Mulholland Drive, to me, it kind of... It is very accidental, and it just seems really masterful. And I think I appreciate that the most about Lynch, is that not needing to tell you how he did it.
Okay, well, I think that we are reaching the end of this episode. Thank you so much to have joined us tonight, French time, for this tribute to David Lynch. We felt that it was important to take the time to talk about that artist, about that man, about his influence, about his legacy. Usually our podcasts are about films or about TV series, but we wanted to make an exception for David Lynch because he's very important to us, and I think that he was very, I mean, he is still very important to all of us, and he left a big hole, which is perfect for someone who liked donuts so much, and unfortunately, it's a very difficult time right now in the United States, and I think he would probably say that we are definitely in the Kali Yuga. Let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that things improve as soon as possible for all of us.
Yep. Because light always shines through a hole.
Exactly.
There you go.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images podcast on social media.